informal talk, so the Blackboard, I think, works a little bit better than projector. I tried to pitch the talk. I don't have a lot of experience talking to high school students, so I hope I pitched the talk at the right level. I know this is sort of a technical audience, but if I'm glossing over something that I shouldn't be glossing over or being too slow, just let me know. So my plan for the talk is maybe 5 minutes of unsolicited advice. And then I don't know if the other speakers did this as well. Okay. And then maybe 55 minutes of rambling about cosmology. All right, so unsolicited advice. I actually made some notes. So I want to start first with like the most boring conventional piece of advice that one human being can give to another one, which is that, so I'm pitching this advice, but assuming that you're thinking seriously about studying physics, like in college or for a career. So you know, one thing that is definitely true is that I think long-term success in physics depends on just working super hard. So even though talent is obviously plays a super important role in physics, I don't know any good theoretical physicists who didn't work really hard in addition to being quite talented. And I hate to give this advice since I love the fantasy of like being so smart that I can get away with being lazy. But unfortunately, it's true. Theoretical physics is just this huge road. And to get to the end of it, well, you never really get to the end of it, but to make progress, you just have to hammer all of this information into your brain, and that's just a huge time-consuming task that takes a lot of work. So as a corollary to that piece of advice, I think you have to do something that you really enjoy. I just don't see any other way that you're going to put in all the time unless you really like it. You know, if it's a chore, if theoretical physics was a chore, you would just never do it. Like everything really good that I've done in physics was the result of, just being really inspired and staying up all night to because I really wanted to know the answer to a question, or I really wanted to understand something. And I think if you didn't have that driving you, at some point you would just start doing the minimum that you needed to get by, and then you would just sort of fall behind. You wouldn't be able to keep going. That's not to say that theoretical physics is just easy and inspiring every day. Sometimes, I will admit, sometimes it's a chore and sometimes it can be frustrating. But I think if you don't have some sort of, you know, big picture inspiration, then it's just going to be really hard to make progress. So people sometimes ask, like people who are thinking about studying physics, well, should I pursue this career path? Should I study physics in college? Should I pursue it as a career? And I think the right answer is to turn the question around and just say, how much do you like physics? You should try it. And if it turns out that you really like it, you should do it. And if not, you should explore other things. That's kind of like obvious common sense advice, but it's possible to not follow it. Another corollary is just to explore your interests. My interests changed quite a bit over the years. I don't think anyone that at an early stage should be committing themselves, should be saying, I'm setting out in life to be a theoretical physicist, and this is like the end-all, be-all goal. The advice that I would give anyone is to sort of explore a few things, see what you like as you probe further, and do something you really enjoy. So these are actually sort of general common sense advice that doesn't apply specifically to physics. Specific advice for studying physics, I think understanding of physics is really rooted in doing a lot of problems. Like I've never successfully understood a new topic in physics without just sitting down and doing a bunch of problems or calculations. Sometimes you can think up your own problems. If there's something, you know, a question that you're wondering about, that's great. You can work out the answer yourself. It's tempting to sort of skip ahead by understanding things at a hand-waving level, but in my experience, hand-waving knowledge of physics doesn't get you very far. You can't really apply it to anything. But if you can do problems, then if you have calculational fluency in something, then you understand it. You can move on. Another piece of advice is that it's okay if it's frustrating. I think all of us have struggled to understand something that we felt like maybe we should understand, but it took a while. Maybe you had to put it aside and come back to it later. I think that's normal, and it's easy to get the sense that other people around you aren't struggling, aren't frustrated, but of course they just don't advertise it. They keep their frustration secret. Finally, there's a certain phenomenon that I've noticed in people that are studying physics, which is that, when you start out, it's really all about just learning procedures and solving problems, and everything is presented as sort of a cookbook, and that's okay. That's a good way to start learning, but then at some point you have to kind of do it yourself, and so there's a certain... It's hard to really articulate what I'm trying to say here, but there's a certain type of technical creativity that you have to develop. I'm calling it technical creativity to distinguish it from, say, artistic creativity, where you have a blank canvas and you can do whatever you want. Creativity in physics is more like creativity with constraints. There's things that you're allowed to do and things that you're not allowed to do and checks that have to be satisfied. And so developing, sometimes solving a problem might require you to develop your own little mathematical machine. Like a new notation or something. And so often what happens is people excel in the beginning when they're taking classes, and then they get to research and really struggle. Like I could honestly, I would say it happened to me. I really struggled for about a year. I just didn't make any progress in research, and then I kind of got the hang of it and could attack research problems and make progress. So, a way to develop technical creativity is to... If there's a question that you're wondering the answer to, just work it out, even if it's not, even if you can't look it up. If there's some interesting question, then answering it yourself will develop your understanding. Develop alternative ways to do things. Maybe you can think of two different ways of solving a problem, or some new way that isn't suggested. You have to kind of pretend that as you study things, you kind of have to pretend that you're inventing them. That's maybe the best way I can put it. And finally, another thing that's sometimes expressed as a concern, well, concern is too strong of a word, but, when you're starting physics and maybe thinking about it from a career perspective, it may seem daunting, this whole program of going through college and grad school and then doing some postdocs, but I think that I would... I would base my recommendation of whether to study physics strictly on whether you enjoy it, not whether you think you want to go down that whole road. So I know a lot of people, in fact, most people that I know that started out studying physics didn't pursue that road to the end. Like, they're not professors today. Maybe, 20% of people that I knew, say, in college studying physics are professors now. 100%, I think, of people that... I know that started out studying physics are doing something interesting. Physics is sort of a general toolkit for analyzing problems and stripping away the inessentials, figuring out what's important. And that's really useful in a variety of contexts. I know physicists, they're doing all sorts of stuff. Maybe they switched research fields, or maybe they are doing software development, or running a company, or on Wall Street. There's lots of possible career paths. I think studying physics just really develops your analytical problem-solving skills, and that's just really useful. Life is pretty good if you're a nerd. There's lots of the world really needs nerds. So studying physics just as a way to sort of develop your overall nerd power, I think it turns out to be much more powerful than you think. Okay, so much for unsolicited advice. Now, I want to talk a little bit about cosmology. What I'm going to try to do is, first I'm going to talk a little bit about what our standard cosmological model is, what we've learned about the universe, and then talk for a few minutes about what we might hope to learn in the future. So I want to sort of work through the history. So you guys, I'm sure, are familiar with the Doppler effect, which says that... you know, if something is moving away from you, then waves emitted from that object are shifted to lower frequency. For light, that means that, you know, a distant galaxy which is moving away from you at an appreciable fraction of the speed of light is redshifted, moving towards you is blue-shifted. So, you know, the expanding universe was discovered by Hubble, discovered observationally by Hubble, who was trying to just map out, stare at a bunch of distant galaxies. It's very difficult to tell if you stare at a distant galaxy whether it's moving transverse to the line of sight, but by measuring its redshift, you can tell whether it's moving away from you or towards you. And so Hubble just wanted to understand like the flow of galaxies, their velocities in the neighborhood of the Earth. You know, what he found is that as you look out, galaxies have a statistical preference for being redshifted. It's as if you interpret their redshift as a radial velocity, it's as if the Earth is just sitting in the middle of a big outflow. There's some random scatter around the statistical preference. So if you just look close to the Earth, you see mostly the random scatter. But as you look farther and farther away, this overall redshift takes over. So this is, if you don't know about the expanding universe, this is a really puzzling observation. It appears that the whole universe has been set up to put the Earth at the middle at some privileged point. But this was successfully interpreted in the context of Einstein's theory of general relativity. So I want to talk a little bit about, it's hard to know what to say about general relativity. General relativity is like one of the most beautiful subjects in physics. I think when every physicist first learns it, they're just like really inspired and blown away. So let me start by just offering a comparison with Newton's law of gravity. Newton's laws of gravity. So Newton's laws of gravity can be written down as follows. So for at every point in space, there's a gravitational field G, a vector, which is the sum over all other overall masses in the universe of some gravitational constant g times the object's mass times a vector if rij is the vector from j to I, say. Let's put a minus sign. Going as 1 over the distance squared. And then secondly, so that's a rule that tells you how a collection of masses determine a gravitational field in space. And then there's a rule for saying how the masses respond in turn to the gravitational field. Each mass is driven by a force proportional to its mass m. So those are Newton's laws of gravity. Now Einstein's laws of gravity, you know, couldn't really find any way, if you take a general relativity class, so Einstein's laws of gravity require a bunch of geometric concepts and unfamiliar notation that takes a while to develop. In fact, if you take a class on general relativity, it'll probably be 4 weeks or so before Einstein's equations are even written down. So I want to sort of describe them in like a cartoon language. There are two equations. One is something called, is the analog of Newton's law of gravitation, which is Einstein's equation. Which, like Newton's law, has fields on one side and masses on the other. But the fields in general relativity are geometrical quantities. They, for example, determine the curvature. So, you know, if you're a little bug living on a sphere, then you can notice certain geometric effects. Like if you and your friend start walking in different directions, then your geodesics start to come together and eventually meet up. The sphere is a useful analogy because it's intuitive to think about concepts like curvature by thinking about the embedding in the ambient space. But it's possible to define geometric concepts like curvature in a way that makes no reference to the ambient space. And these curvature-like quantities are what appears on the left-hand side of Einstein's equation. It's curvature of space-time. There's a time, you know, a four-dimensional space-time with some curvature, so you know the presence of the matter in the spacetime, is setting the curvature and other geometric notions like distance in the spacetime. And number two, the analog of Newton's force law is the geodesic equation, which simply says that once you've applied Einstein's equation and determined the geometry, then the response of a particle to the geometry is just simply to go in a straight line, a geodesic, appropriate for that geometry. So for example, the statement, you know, just a familiar situation like two point masses being attracted to each other. As usual in physics, we're sort of hardwired to draw these world line diagrams where time runs up. What's happening here is that the notion of distance in this two-dimensional space-time is such that the shortest distance between two paths is to between two points is to take a curved path, which draws the particles together. So when Einstein's equations, now one thing I don't like lecturing about physics in a hand-waving way where I can't really write equations down, but the best thing to do is to just emphasize which equations are coming from equations that I haven't written down and which equations can be derived from things that I have. So when Einstein's equation is applied to the whole universe, you get what are called Friedman's equations, which I can write down. They're the following special case of Einstein's equations. So first off, the geometry is characterized by a function a of t, which is called the scale factor. Which tells me, so what that represents geometrically is that, you know, if here's time from say, the Big Bang until now, and here are two galaxies that are very far away from each other, so they're not, their attraction to each other, say, is negligible. They're not moving around. Then if an observer at time t measures the distance, the physical distance with a ruler between the galaxies, then they'll find that it evolves proportional to the scale factor a of t. So a of t is like the conversion between coordinate distance and physically measured distance. So you know, to write down an equation for that, if an observer measures delta x at time t1, they'll find that it's just scaled by the ratio of the a's compared to the distance that would be measured at time t0. Okay, so the geometry is just specified by the single function of a single variable. And Friedman's equations say that the physics of that, of how that variable evolves, is given by a couple of equations. So this equation says that the derivative of A is this expression times, oh, this should, no square. Oh, yeah, it should be. The quantity in parentheses here is just the total energy density. Rho is the matter density. Total energy density. Which, and say grams per cubic centimeter, which in Einstein's time, they didn't know about the cosmological constant yet, so they would have said that it's the sum of a contribution from matter, which means non-relativistic particles, and radiation, photons or light neutrinos or relativistic particles. Okay, so that's one equation. The other thing that you need to know is that these densities evolve, the density of non-relativistic particles goes as the scale factor to the minus 3, and the density of relativistic particles goes as a of t to the minus 4. These follow by brute force calculation from if you know Einstein's equations, but they can be interpreted intuitively. The fact that the matter density goes a scale factor to the minus 3 is just the statement that particle number is conserved, so that if I measure the density at one time and then measure it again at a later time, then volume, all physical distances have increased by a, so physical densities go down as 1 over a cubed, the volume, physically measured volume has changed. The energy density of radiation goes as 1 with 1 more power of a, because if you have a bunch of photons, say, their number is conserved, but they're also redshifting and losing energy. This is a differential equation. You can solve it to figure out how A evolves with time. You guys have probably solved differential equations before, but if you haven't, you know, the way it works intuitively is that if you say we're today, we know the scale factor today, and we also know these densities. Then this equation, then Friedman's equation, is telling us the slope in the AT plane. So that tells us if we make a small step in T, how much to evolve A by. Then at the new A, we can update the density of matter and the density of radiation. Those change a little, which let us plug back in and get the new slope, and so on until we flesh out the curve. And of course, you can do the same thing backwards in time. If you solve, if you integrate, like this is how a computer solves differential equations. So if you solve or integrate this differential equation, then you get the following type of behavior. It goes as t to the 1 half, the scale factor goes as t to the 2 thirds today. If you go back to a sufficiently early time, as you go backward in time, the radiation density is increasing compared to the matter density. There'll be some switch over time where the energy density of the universe is dominated by radiation. There's more energy density in photons than there is in non-relativistic particles. And the scale factor starts going as 2 to the 1 half. Now, the geodesic, so that's Einstein's equation in this special case. What the geodesic equation says is that if I want to know how a particle moves in this geometry, the trajectory of the particle is the trajectory which minimizes the space-time distance. If this were a Euclidean geometry, then in a Euclidean plane, the distance would be given by this expression. If I take the dx and the dy are supposed to stand for small steps. So if I just step by some, if I have some path that's composed of a bunch of small steps, then the way I compute the length of the path is for each step, I have an x and a y displacement. I just compute the distance, the associated distance, add up or integrate to get the length of the path. In space-time, it's similar, except that you have, let me put the squares. In space-time, it's similar, except for there's a minus sign. So this funny quantity, like a distance with a minus sign, is what particle is trying to, in this case, maximize as it moves through space-time. So you can imagine playing this little game. If you're here at one space-time point, x0, t0, and you want to travel to this other point, x1, t1, let's start with the case where the x's are the same and the times are different. If you want to maximize this quantity, this ds, by the way, is actually just the time that you measure as you if you carry a clock along a path in space-time. So That time can be different because of the twin paradox. If you make a big excursion and come back, you decrease the time on your clock. Okay, so if I had the same point at different times, then if I just take the straight line path between the points, then I end up with some space-time interval dt. And then if I put wiggles around that path, those wiggles always come in with a minus sign, so I get a smaller value for the space-time interval, space-time interval ds. So it's easy to see that the best path to take, the path which maximizes this quantity, is just to move on this straight line, which of course just means that a particle that starts out at rest stays at rest. It doesn't wander around to reach the same point at a different time. A more interesting case is where we displace the points. You might imagine by analogy with the Euclidean case that the best strategy for maximizing this quantity is to go straight from one point, from one to the other. But there's a better way to go because, and that would in fact be the best strategy if A were constant. But if A is changing with time, if A is small here and large here, then what you want to do, because motion along the x-axis is penalizing you, it comes in with a minus sign, what you want to do is move more at early times where the penalty is smaller, where the A is smaller. And so you end up with a path like this, and that is, in fact, how you derive the redshifting or the decrease of velocities in general relativity. I start out with a large velocity, and then the velocity slows down. That just comes out of Einstein's equation. So particles that move in an expanding universe slow down or redshift with time. So it's really a beautiful meeting of observation and theory that Hubble, you know, made these puzzling observations. And then Einstein's equation, Einstein came along with his theory of general relativity and came up with a framework that explained them perfectly. Okay. Einstein, by the way, didn't like the idea of an expanding universe. So he realized that his theory predicted it. But he thought it just couldn't be right. So he tried to sort of doctor up his theory by imagining that there's another source of energy, which is just due to the vacuum itself. So if you imagine that the vacuum has some non-zero energy density, which is a fundamental constant, a free parameter in physics, you can give it a negative sign. So imagine that this is constant. Let's write it as a of t to the zero. So Einstein said, well, I don't like the expanding universe, but if I just sort of propose a new law of physics, namely that the associated with the vacuum itself, there's some non-zero energy density, and the nature has somehow chosen that value in our universe to precisely equal the total energy in matter and photons today, non-relativistic matter and photons today, then I can arrange to have zero on the right-hand side here and the universe won't expand. So he actually sort of missed the chance to predict in advance. This was 1915, and Hubble did his observations in 1929. To predict in advance the expanding universe, he famously called it his greatest blunder. An expanding universe, is a very peculiar place. Integrating this equation shows that A goes to zero, a finite time in the past. So what the A represents is like the physically measured distance between two faraway points in the universe. And it's sort of hard. So what we're actually saying is that if we take some faraway galaxy at a cosmological distance, say a billion light years away, if we measure it now, we'll get some value for the distance, a billion light years. If we measure it later, we'll just find that the distance is different because the space in between is expanded. It's kind of hard. When I first was introduced to this concept, I found it a little bit hard to get my head around. Like, it's sort of, hard to imagine that if we really just waited, you know, a billion years and measured the distance, we would get some other number. We'd have to lay down the ruler a different number of times. But that is what Einstein's, that is what general relativity predicts. And it's well tested. Well, on cosmological scales, we have a very successful theory that explains all sorts of observations that just we would never be able to get if we didn't have general relativity. It involves GR in a really essential way. And it's precisely tested on smaller scales, like the scale of our solar system. In fact, you know, like GPS has to include general relativistic corrections. This space-time interval that measures the time that a clock carried on a world line measures. You actually have to account for that in GPS and figuring out the time delay between satellites that are broadcasting from different positions to a given location. All right. So the expanding universe, one thing that happens in an expanding universe is that structure grows with time through a process of gravitational collapse. This is another thing that you can calculate from Einstein's equations. So the version of Einstein's equation that I wrote down here is for a universe which doesn't contain any fluctuations, just a perfectly uniform distribution of matter characterized only by its energy density. Now that's a good approximation on large scales. If we're just concerned with the evolution of the universe on, say, scales of millions of light years, it's okay to treat things as homogeneous, the same way that you can treat a solid as homogeneous with some density for many purposes, rather than actually keeping track of the individual atoms. Of course, our universe on small scales, on non-cosmological scales, is not uniform. Its matter is broken up into little galaxies and dark matter halos and so on. And so if you work out Einstein's equations with those fluctuations, then what you find is that structure tends to increase with time. So if I have a little fluctuation in the matter density, say this is the matter density versus the spatial coordinate x, then if I measure at a later time, you know, I'll find that the structure has grown due to gravitational instability. If this is a overdense region, then it tends to pull in surrounding matter gravitationally, leading to a larger overdense region oppositely for an underdense region. So structure in the universe grows with time. And if we start throughout most of the universe's history, it grows, the amplitude of a wave grows proportional to 1 power of the scale factor. So, you know, if we look here and we find that fluctuations are of order 10% on a certain scale, if we go back to an A of 1/2, we'll find that they're 5% and so on. So this suggests a picture where we start out with very tiny fluctuations near the Big Bang that seed by gravitational collapse the structure that we see today. Another thing that's really weird and puzzling about the expanding universe is the fact that there is a Big Bang at all. Like, what does it mean? Must have been a real puzzle in like 1929. What does it mean to say that if we, you know, could travel back a finite time in the past, we would find A equals zero, i.e. every 2 points in the universe have a physically measured distance of zero. Everything's on top of everything else. By the way, the Big Bang, I'm sure you guys know this, but the Big Bang doesn't happen at a privileged point in space. It doesn't refer to a place that everything expands from. It just refers to a time when everything was on top of everything else. So it happens at a privileged point in time, but all that's happening is that all distances are small. Okay. So another property of an expanding universe is that it's impossible to avoid the conclusion that at sufficiently early times, I drew this shape wrong. At sufficiently early times, the universe is a plasma. Rather than being, say, a gas of a bunch of hydrogen and helium atoms, everything's disassociated into a bunch of hydrogen and helium nuclei and free electrons. you know, if you, that's just inevitable if you run back the clock with a scale factor that goes to zero. Eventually, if you try to start with a gas, you'll get all the atoms so close to each other that collisions between the atoms will knock the electrons out. So at early times, the temperature is a plasma, and what will happen if you let the universe expand, if the whole universe is full of a plasma and you let the universe expand, is that its temperature goes as 1 over the scale factor. That's basically because the photons are redshifting as 1 over the scale factor, and it's the energy of the photons that determines the temperature of the plasma. Okay, so we don't really know. The presence of the Big Bang itself, if we're pretending that we're physicists in 1929, is some sort of signal that our theory doesn't make sense anymore and we don't know the correct laws of physics. But we can follow the evolution back to where the universe was a plasma. There's a cutoff temperature of around 3000 Kelvin when a free plasma of protons and electrons will combine into a gas of hydrogen atoms. And it's the light from this early plasma, redshifted until now, that we experience as the cosmic microwave background. So you can imagine, you know, as you look back, the plasma is opaque. It can't transmit light. So you can imagine that as we look back, as we look out further and further in the universe, we're looking back farther and farther in time. If you could look out far enough, for example, you would see a universe with no galaxies because gravitational instability hadn't magnified the initial structure enough to form galaxies. So you would see galaxies for a while, and then you would look back through what's called the Dark Ages, which are like the first billion years or so after the Big Bang. And then you would eventually see a wall. I mean, it is best thought of as a literal wall of plasma, which is the cosmic microwave background. And you can't look any further than that, at least with light. You can try to look further with other things like neutrinos or gravity waves. The early universe, when you look back to this plasma surface, you see a universe which has very little structure. At this early time, this is a... when the universe had a scale factor of about 10 to the minus 3 compared to its current value. So all structure is suppressed by a factor of 1,000. And you just see... you see a mostly homogeneous universe. The only sense in which the universe is structured is that if I look at this part of the plasma, I see a slightly different temperature at the level of one part in 10 to the 3 or so compared to a different region. So this plasma surface is divided up into a bunch of hot and cold spots that differ very little from each other in absolute temperature. And that's, of course, what we have. Since I was doing a Blackboard talk, I didn't have the slide, but I brought the CMB beach ball, which is actually not a bad representation of the data. So this was this came from a satellite experiment called WMAP, which I was fortunate enough to work on. NASA sort of had these printed up as swag. I used to have a ton of them, which was super fun. They were really fun to give to people, but now I only have two left. They're kind of like rare commodities now. You can see, so this stripe was left in on purpose. This is the plane of our galaxy. If you go off the, normally when we analyze the data, we have a way of cleaning it out. But just, I guess, to make the ball more interesting, they left it in. This actually is more like what you would see if you just observed the microwave sky at a single frequency channel. Off the plane, so that you're not looking through our galaxy and seeing a bunch of astrophysical emission, you see these little hot and cold spots, which are regions of the universe that were where the plasma was slightly denser and hotter, or slightly colder and less dense than average. And these are the little spots at very early times, shortly after the Big Bang, that have magnified over time to become the structure we're familiar with. Now, the way we actually analyze the cosmic microwave background is by its power spectrum. So I want to tell you a little bit about what that is. So the map of the sky, the map of hot and cold spots, or the temperature field T of x, where x is a position on the sky, is processed to compute something called the power spectrum, which if you go to talks about the cosmic microwave background, you're guaranteed to see a plot like this, which has an angular scale on the x-axis and a power, level of power on the y-axis. It looks something like this. So intuitively what this plot represents is, I think a familiar analogy is with, if you see sound channelized, you can take an audio stream and plot its power spectrum, which has a frequency, say, in kilohertz, and then a level of power on the y-axis. So for a real, instrument, you might also see some peaks, say. A real musical instrument will have peaks. Which is telling you that, this violin, say, has a harmonic, has a, is mostly pitched at a kilohertz, but has, say, a higher harmonic at 2 kilohertz, and so on. So this is sort of the analogous thing for where you replace time by position on the sky, and the displacement of, or the pressure at a time t, which is what's in a sound wave, by temperature at a point x. The L here is rather than being like a temporal frequency, is an angular wave number. So a given scale is identified by the number of oscillations it makes as you go around the whole sky, as you traverse one great circle on the sky. So an L of, say, 200, which is where the first peak is, corresponds to a wavelength in the map, which is just 2 pi divided by 200. It makes 200 full wavelengths as you go all the way around the sky. So this is a scale of about a degree. And in fact, just like the violin has a characteristic pitch, these peaks indicate preferred sizes of hot and cold spots in the cosmic microwave background. So if you look at this map, if I printed a different beach ball with a so-called scale invariant power spectrum, something which is flat, I claim that you would be able to tell the difference. You'd be able to see in the real beach ball that there's a preferred 1 degree size of hot and cold spots compared to a scale invariant map. In cosmology, or more generally in physics, we get really used to Fourier transforming everything. So we sort of internalize being able to stare at this plot and say, well, what this plot means is that there's a characteristic 1 degree size, which is preferred. And then there's also sort of a cutoff scale, which is smoothing things out. If I magnified the map, eventually, if I magnified enough, I would get to a scale where all of the hot and cold spots were removed. I wouldn't just keep seeing more and more power as I kept expanding the map. Since you guys are That's what it means intuitively to write some equations down. If we start with the sound wave first, if we think of sound as a pressure at time t, then the way a plot like this is made is first you Fourier transform the pressure. So I represent the Fourier transform means that, let's write it as a sum, that I represent, let's do the integral. I can take an arbitrary P of t, which if we plotted it with good time resolution might, show a bunch of wiggles. And I represent it as a sum of many oscillatory signals, oscillatory waveforms of the form e to the I nu t, summed or integrated over frequency with some weighting p of nu, which is the Fourier transform of p. So if I plotted p of nu is a complex quantity, then that's where I would see these peaks, but I would see them with random phases. So if I plotted, say, just the real part of p of nu, I would see, you know, a bunch of power at the characteristic frequencies of the instrument. And so the way that this curve is made is just by squaring. I shouldn't have used the notation p. Let's call this f. So the Fourier transform is just sort of representing a waveform as a sum of oscillatory waveforms. And then the power spectrum is obtained by just squaring and then doing some sort of, the power spectrum is just the square of f of nu, with some averaging applied to smooth out the wiggles. This is defined in an analogous way. It's just in two dimensions. So you start with a temperature at a point x, y on the sky and represent it as Fourier transform it to represent it as a sum of plane waves, and then just square the quantity called CL is just the square of the Fourier transform with some sort of averaging applied to so that you're just keeping track of the power on a particular scale without reference to the direction of propagation of that wave on the sky, and also with some averaging applied to smooth things out. So I'd like to give some insight into why this power spectrum has the shape that it does. Oh, I only have 10 minutes left. Well,
oh my God, there's this time dilation effect where every time I stand in front of the blackboard, it takes like so much longer to say everything than I think it's going to take.
Oh, great. Time dilation effect was compensated by a corresponding effect, which is I didn't look at my schedule. Okay, great. So I'd like to give some insight into why this the power spectrum of the hot and cold spots in the cosmic microwave background has the shape that it does. So the physics of the universe before we observe the plasma surface is sort of different from the physics of the universe afterwards, in that a plasma is pressure supported so that fluctuations can't grow or can't grow nearly as much by gravitational collapse. So nowadays, if we had some sort of density wave in the universe, it would grow gravitationally with time. But in the early universe, if it was out here at early times, then it would propagate as a sound wave in the plasma without undergoing much gravitational magnification. So these peaks are, in fact, what you see, what you get if you just let a sound wave evolve for a while and then freeze the evolution at a particular time. If you imagine that, because of the magic of Fourier transforms, we can sort of we can think about the early universe like one Fourier mode at a time. So if I imagine that in the early universe, I started with some fluctuation, some random fluctuation at some 3D wave number k. So let's assume that the temperature of the plasma was some constant times, say, to make it real, cosine of kx in the initial conditions. Then at time t, what would happen is that this sound wave would evolve. If this is what's happening in the initial conditions, then at time t,
What happens is that there's just some this thing starts oscillating. The frequency of the oscillation omega will be equal to the sound speed of the plasma times the wave number k of the mode. And so if I observe the mode at some late, you know, at some later time t, then I'll catch it with a phase which is proportional to this cosine. So in particular, that applies at the time at the time of the formation t, c, and b. So if I were to say take delta t, let's square it so that we're talking about power, then I would get this amplitude in front times the spatial piece. So the amplitude of the wave has this cosine squared in front of it. When we think about evolving a wave, we imagine fixing k and varying t. But if we think about freezing the plasma so that we observe the C and B, then we're thinking about fixing t, we observe it at a fixed time, and varying k, so that that same just trig function behavior would show up as a bunch of oscillations with some characteristic location, which is determined by the sound speed times the formation time of the C and B, or in other words, just the distance that sound travels when the C and B is formed. Now, this simple oscillation doesn't capture a lot of the plasma physics. There are a bunch of other effects here, like the projection from 3D to 2D. There's all sorts of GR effects that happen when we observe the last scattering surface. The actual detailed physics is quite complicated. But at sort of a cartoon level, what's happening is that this peaky structure is telling you something about, is telling you that the early universe is just, that the physics of the early universe is the physics of sound waves, with some characteristic scale, which is determined by the sound horizon, or the distance that the sound travels in the plasma, that a disturbance travels between the Big Bang and the time when the CMB is observed. So this is kind of a fundamental parameter that we can observe in the CMB. You know, as another example, this damping on small scales, that happens because as the plasma is combining, as the plasma is converting to a gas of neutral atoms, that process isn't instantaneous. So toward the end of that process, there's some finite distance that a photon can travel, which is neither zero as it would be in a perfect ideal plasma, or infinite as it would be in a perfectly transparent gas. And the effect of that mean free path is to smooth out fluctuations whose wavelength is smaller than some characteristic scale. So if I have a very long wavelength mode, it doesn't matter that the photons aren't perfectly coupled to the plasma and they can wander a little bit. As long as that wandering is small compared to the wavelength of the mode, the evolution of the mode is undisturbed. But if I have a very short wavelength mode, then random walking of the photons from here to here will just smooth things out and suppress power. So another parameter we can observe in the CMB is the mean free path of the plasma near the transition from plasma to neutral gas. The reason that these parameters are interesting, so this is like a mean free path. The reason that these parameters are interesting is that they're linked to cosmological parameters. They're determined by quantities like the abundance of matter, the abundance of dark matter, the expansion history between now and the CMB, and so on. So this is what we observe. Then we can try to understand it. We can try to cook up models that explain I haven't explained everything. Like, the heights of the peaks tell you something about the detailed physics of the plasma. The way that we, the complete physics that determines this curve is incredibly complicated. I mean, not in theory. In theory, it's just not, or not in principle. In principle, it's just 19th century physics. Well, 19th century physics plus general relativity. But the complete set of differential equations that describe the evolution of the plasma is a really long, complicated set of equations that are really always, in practice, always solved by computer. The computer programs that, even just writing down all the equations was kind of a tour de force, was only done in like the 1970s, and was just kind of a tour de force of calculation. And the computer programs that integrate them and compute this curve, compute the power spectrum, are surprisingly complicated. There's something like tens of thousands of lines of code, maybe 30,000 lines of code to evolve the differential equations. There's all sorts of nasty stuff in there, like to get the details of the transition correct from a plasma universe to a transparent universe. You need to include all sorts of nasty atomic physics that keeps track of, transition rates between different levels of the hydrogen atom, values of, different N and L, some enormous set of equations. It's not even totally clear that the details of that atomic physics have been 100% worked out. Okay. Anyway, what we've learned from the cosmic microwave background and other observations what's interesting is that we found a number of surprises. So the first surprise, I think, is three surprises. One is the existence of dark matter. So this was the history of how dark matter was initially proposed as kind of murky. It was first, I think the first proposal, the first proposals that dark matter might exist weren't taken very seriously by astronomers. People just sort of noticed that if you look at so-called rotation curves of spiral galaxies, I have a galaxy. The rotation rate of the arms at a given distance depends on how much mass is enclosed at that distance. It was difficult, even with observations of galaxies in like the 1950s, to reconcile the rotation rate of the arms with the distribution of gas in the galaxy. So if the galaxy itself was doing all the gravitating, there just didn't seem to be enough mass to rotate the arms enough. But everything's okay if you assume that this galaxy is embedded. We now understand the galaxy is embedded in some dark matter halo, which is just some clump of dark matter, which is larger than the galaxy. I don't know if I had been an astronomer around at the time, I would have found this explanation kind of ridiculous, that the reason why we're mispredicting the rotation rate of arms of galaxies is because the whole universe is full of some mysterious new particle. I would have probably thought that this had more to do with how we were incorrect modeling of the galaxy itself. Like, maybe there's just a bunch of gas that's not in stars, which is providing the gravitation. So the dark matter hypothesis for a long time in physics was just kind of like this boogeyman that was invoked whenever you didn't think that you understood something. But it turned out to be correct. So nowadays, for example, we can make really detailed maps of the mass surrounding a galaxy using, for example, gravitational lensing by background galaxies. On the galactic scale, the dark matter extends way out beyond the galaxy itself. In fact, if we observe a galaxy cluster, with a bunch of galaxies, there's a bunch of mass very far away, which really can't be gas, or it would have collapsed and formed a galaxy. We see it in the Milky Way itself. To get the dynamics of stars in the Milky Way correct, you need to know that the Milky Way is sort of permeated by a bunch of matter, which is on the scale of our galaxy, is is sort of smooth and featureless. If I just live in this galaxy, then I don't see the edges of the dark matter halo. It just looks like I'm embedded in a uniform density of dark matter. And on cosmological scales, you can't get the power spectrum, you know, even remotely correct without invoking dark matter, where without putting dark matter, non-zero dark matter density into the equations of motion for the plasma. So the dark matter affects the physics of the plasma quite a bit, because whereas a plasma wave oscillates as a sound wave, as we were talking about here, dark matter doesn't have any associated pressure. If there's an overdense region here, the dark matter just falls in and doesn't, there's no pressure to drive it back out and propagate sound. So a plasma of ions and dark matter, if you integrate its equations of motion, gives quite a different power spectrum from a plasma that contains only ions and electrons alone. At one point for a talk, I tried fitting. This curve nowadays, by the way, is measured to like roughly the thickness of the line. Well, that's not true down here on large scales or in very small scales, but throughout most of the plot, it's measured incredibly well by modern experiments. If you try to fit the curve without putting in dark matter, you just get something that's grossly, I can't actually draw it for you, but just grossly inconsistent with the observed peak shapes. So from the cosmic microwave background alone, statistical evidence for dark matter is something like 80 sigma. So what we know about dark matter is that it, we don't know very much. We know that its self-interactions are small. We know that its couplings to ordinary matter or standard model particles are small. And we know that it gravitates. All of our evidence for dark matter is purely gravitational. In fact, the reason that we see it in the CMB is because, you know, when a dark matter wave collapses, it exerts a gravitational pull on the rest of the plasma, which affects the physics and the shape of the power spectrum. Or, you know, likewise, when we observe it, all of these observations are gravitational, the rotation rates of galaxies, gravitational lensing. And we know that there's about five times as much as ordinary matter. The total density of dark matter in the universe and the total density of ordinary matter are parameters that we can fit very precisely from the CMB. Five times as much as ordinary matter. From these facts alone, we would like to understand what dark matter is. I think the real question we're trying to answer is, why does dark matter exist? If you just want to understand dark matter at an observational level, right, like, or at a phenomenological level, you just need to know what rules, what physics you put into your equations of motion to explain the cosmic microwave background and other observations, then these facts are enough. But from the point of view of theoretical physics, we think it's a meaningful question to answer and that we will learn a lot by understanding, why does dark matter exist? Is there some reason why, you know, our standard model requires it? Is there some connection between the physics that we know about and the physics of dark matter? It's a fundamental puzzle. From these facts alone, I don't think that you can say much about this question. There's just too many possible explanations, too much room to extend the standard model in a way that introduces a particle with these properties. To say more, I think we need to improve these, sharpen these statements. When we say the self-interactions are small, we mean that we have some upper bound for a given type of self-interaction. There's some upper bound on the strength that avoids screwing up, say, the CMB. if the self-interactions of dark matter are non-zero, or the couplings to the standard model are non-zero, which you'd imagine, or if there's some sort of non-gravitational coupling, then we eventually should be able to see it. There are lots of experiments, lab experiments, that use like big tanks of noble gases so that when a dark matter particle comes through, you know, these statements mean, of course, that dark matter just streams through the Earth, the ordinary matter. But if there's some small probability to interact with a, you know, an atom of a noble gas in a big tank, then that's something we can try to observe. Or you might try to look for dark matter decay, if dark matter annihilates, or, you know, if two dark matter particles can come together and have an interaction that produces standard model particles. You might observe gamma rays astrophysically. So there's huge campaigns in physics to try to observe some sort of signal from dark matter. And when that's, if and when that's observed, that will narrow things down a lot. But for the time being, we're just kind of stuck with this question. It's one of the big unsolved puzzles in physics. Puzzle number two is the existence of dark energy. Dark energy is not a very good name. Actually, for that matter, dark matter is not a very good name. It should be called transparent matter. That's the proper physics term for something that doesn't couple to light. Dark would mean that it absorbs light. Anyway, dark energy, it's not a very good name, but it just refers to the mismatch between the evolution of the scale factor, or let's say the expansion history, that's observed, versus a universe full of ordinary particles, relativistic or non-relativistic particles. Let me put up, I erased them, so let me put up the equations that I had before. So you know, general relativity in 1929 would have predicted that the expansion history of our universe is whatever you get when you integrate this differential equation with contributions to the energy density proportional to a to the minus 3 and a to the minus 4, respectively. One nice way of quantifying things is that if you compute the acceleration, so this is a calculation that is not hard to do. If you take the derivative of this equation, use these equations to differentiate rho and rho matter and rho radiation, and then simplify a little bit. The second derivative of A turns out to have this form. There's an A. The rho matter, and then there's a contribution from radiation, which is 2. The only thing that's qualitatively important about this equation is that the sign is always negative. You get a negative contribution from non-relativistic matter and a contribution from radiation matter, which happens to be twice as much. If I put something in between, like a particle that was, you know, in between the limits of being very non-relativistic or very relativistic, it would come in with a coefficient that's between 1 and 2, but always positive. So if you fill the universe with particles, whether they're relativistic or not, you always get an acceleration which is negative. This is not what's observed. What's observed is an acceleration which is positive today, negative if you go back far enough. If you go back to a scale factor of around a half, When we do cosmology, we tend to use the scale factor as the clock. Like, rather than say 5 billion years ago or some number, I tend to just refer to the amount of expansion that's taken place between then and now. You do indeed find the negative sign. The expansion history can be mapped out in different ways, like observing supernovae at cosmological distances, or power spectra. The cosmic microwave background helps a bit. You can get some constraints on the expansion history, but the best constraints come from like measuring galaxies and computing their power spectra. So when this was first discovered, there were a lot of possible explanations, and there still are. One explanation is going back to Einstein's one sort of front-runner explanation is going back to Einstein's greatest blunder, where he put in the cosmological constant. Now, you'll recall that Einstein wanted to put in a negative cosmological constant in order to make the expansion rate zero. But if we try to increase the expansion rate to get this, what's observed, at least at recent times, is a positive. If we put the cosmological constant in with a positive sign to try to blow up the expansion at late times, the cosmological constant, the energy density of the vacuum, is constant in time. It goes like a to the zero. And it comes in with a sign here, which is minus 2, I believe. I'm getting these numbers from what you get if you do the general relativity calculation, with Einstein's equations. So that's one explanation. Another explanation is that maybe there's something wrong with Einstein's equations in the first place. Maybe this is telling us, to be a bit more open-minded, this is just telling us that if we take the constituents of the universe that we've observed, particles, and then apply Einstein's theory of gravity, it predicts one thing, and what we observe is something different. So maybe there's just something wrong with our understanding of gravity itself that's, for some reason, is only important at the universe's largest scales, or only at recent times in the evolution of the universe. Over time, the data has sharpened so that this cosmological constant explanation looks more and more consistent with the data. I would say that data are not so precise that this is conclusive. If you want sort of a rough ballpark, we can measure things to sort of 10% or so. The cosmological constant exponent hypothesis for the observed acceleration of the universe, makes a detailed prediction for exactly what expansion history should observe, if it's correct. And we can sort of match, the observations match that prediction to about 10%. There's still some room. I would say if you got to 1% or so, then I would personally be pretty convinced. But there's still some room maybe for this observation to be telling us something, to be telling us that Einstein's theory of gravity is not the final story. To make progress, here we're going to need more data. And if the cosmological constant turns out to be the correct explanation, then we'd like to answer the corresponding why type question as well. So here the question is why is the cosmological constant so small and non-zero? In its natural units and in Planck units, the cosmological constant is something like 10 to the minus 120. That's in units of Planck mass to the fourth. That's a constant of nature. It's just something, it's independent of time. It's just some energy density of the vacuum that's always the same. So why does nature why does our description of nature include this number, which is 100, zero for the first 120 digits, and then starts becoming non-zero? It would be great to have some sort of understanding of that. In fact, you can find famous physicists that were sort of making fun of the idea of searching for the cosmological constant observationally, because from a fundamental physics point of view, it just seems, it flies in the face of our concepts of naturalness in physics to have a number which is so tiny and non-zero. And the last mystery is the physics of the very beginning. Which is like one of my favorite things in physics. Let me try to do it justice. So one thing I haven't really talked about, so in the Big Bang model, if you assume this expanding universe and you assume a certain type of initial conditions which are small, then we know how to turn the crank of all the equations of motion and get the power spectrum of the CMB and, a bunch of other things that I haven't talked about, like power spectra of galaxies and gravitational lensing. We can get everything correct, but we don't. This theory tells you what initial conditions to use as part of the as an input, but it doesn't explain where they came from. Just for fun, let me write down the initial conditions. So the in GR notation, so this equation, which I had on the board before, is how in GR we would specify an expanding universe with a scale factor that depends on time but not space. In our current standard model of cosmology, which I'll write down in a minute, the initial conditions, you get the right initial conditions. If I multiply this function of time alone by a function of space alone, where this field zeta is called the initial curvature, or you might, initial adiabatic curvature is also a term you might hear. Now, what we need to assume about this field is that, one thing we can measure from the cosmic microwave background very well is the power spectrum of this field. So I can tell you, in the initial conditions of our universe, what is the, on a given scale or 3D wave number k, at a given wavelength, what's the typical size of this fluctuation in the initial conditions? And what you get is a nearly flat power spectrum. There's a small tilt, a small increase as you go to low k or large wave numbers. There are no features like there are in the power spectrum of the CMB. Those features arise from processing this featureless power spectrum by a bunch of acoustic physics. Another thing that's true about this initial curvature is that it's a so it has a nearly flat power spectrum. Another thing that's true about this field is that it's what we call a Gaussian field. What this means is that the statistics of the field are completely determined by the power spectrum, by scaling a bunch of Gaussian random variables, variables distributed with the bell curve Gaussian distribution, by the power spectrum. So if you, for example, wanted to, on the computer, construct a random realization of the initial conditions of our universe, what you would do is take a 3D box, Fourier transform it, and then assign in each wave number k an amplitude which was a Gaussian random number whose amplitude is controlled by this power spectrum at a given scale k, but whose average amplitude or the width of the distribution, but whose detailed distribution is given by the bell curve. So these two statements completely are all that you need to describe the initial conditions. So this is part of the standard model of cosmology, that our universe starts out as a bunch of fluctuations in the geometry that look like this, with a nearly flat power spectrum and Gaussian statistics. Now, where those fluctuations might come from is quantum mechanics. So let's talk about quantum mechanics for 5 minutes. Without quantum mechanics, you're always stuck without a complete understanding of the initial conditions because, you know, the only thing you have working for you is gravitational instability, which can magnify small fluctuations, but it can't create fluctuations out of nothing. But in quantum mechanics, you can get something from nothing. And let's start with a simple problem that you study in physics, first in classical mechanics, and then again in quantum mechanics, is say the behavior of a simple harmonic oscillator. So there's some quantity x. It could be like the position of a mass on a spring or the angle of a pendulum. Some quantity x whose potential energy is quadratic. In classical mechanics, a particle with a quadratic potential energy will just undergo simple harmonic oscillation. And in particular, if the particle starts out at its ground state, its state of minimum energy, it just sits there forever. In quantum mechanics, it's not possible to confine a particle to a one location. So a quantum mechanical, if you were to study the behavior of a mass on the spring and spring very carefully, if it was a very tiny mass and a very tiny spring, so the quantum mechanics is important, or a pendulum, anything that undergoes simple harmonic motion classically, quantum mechanically there'll be some spread, like the particle is in some fuzzy state. There's a wave function that describes like the probability distribution for the particle, which isn't perfectly sharp, but has some spread around the minimum. Now, but a quantum mechanical particle in its ground state will just stay in that ground state forever. Now, something interesting happens if the parameters of this potential are changed externally. If, for example, you had a quantum mechanical mass on a spring, and you could reach in and turn a little knob, which increases the spring constant, or, you know, in the case of the pendulum, like it changed the length of the string, then what might happen is that this potential might change. It's still quadratic, but it has some different amplitude. And if that change happens quickly, then particle doesn't have time to change its wave function to compensate. If it changes slowly, there's an equation of motion, Schrodinger's equation, for the wave function of a quantum mechanical degree of freedom. And you could show from that equation that if you change the potential slowly, then and you start in the ground state, then the particle is able to stay in the ground state. But if you change it quickly, then what happens is the wave function doesn't have time to keep up, so to speak. The wave function is stuck in the grounds in the functional form that would be appropriate for one potential. But now the potential is something else that's not in the right state, and so it looks like an excited state of the system. So quantum mechanically, you know, if I had a mass on the spring and I suddenly change the spring constant, now I find that it's got some energy associated with it that is larger than the energy of the ground state. Now, if you imagine that you had many springs, for example, in a solid, you can think of the displacement of every atom in the solid. You know, atoms, if you push two atoms together, they'll repel each other. And so you can think of a solid as, you know, a bunch of masses connected by springs. Let's imagine that the solid starts out in its ground state. It's just thermally isolated and at absolute zero. If I could suddenly change the spring constants, which you can't do in a real solid, but if you could somehow, then what you would find is that the collective modes of the system are excited out of their ground state by the same sort of thing that's happening here. And excitations in, if I have a many particle system, excitations above the ground state are what we, are your system with many degrees of freedom. Excitations are above the ground state are what we understand, you know, in modern physics to be particles. So this doesn't really have to be a bunch of masses connected by springs. This can just be some field, like the electromagnetic field in space-time. If it were possible to reach in and change strength of electromagnetism in the universe suddenly, you would suddenly, if you've studied electromagnetism, change the parameter epsilon naught, then you would find suddenly that the whole universe was full of photons. Now, there's a model for explaining the initial conditions of our universe, which is kind of a wild idea, and it's actually kind of amazing to me that anyone ever thought of it, which says that if you suppose that the early universe, so far I've described a history of the universe where, you know, today we have mostly non-relativistic particles driving the expansion. If you went back early enough before the CMB was formed, photons would dominate. If before that, you replace the energy density of the universe by there's many ways to do it, but the simplest way is to imagine that the energy density of the universe is dominated by some field, phi, that we don't know about yet. This has to be a new field that we're proposing, with some potential, which is nearly flat. Then, a few things happen. One thing is that it resolves the Big Bang singularity instead of the scale factor going to zero a finite time in the past. There's some exponentially decreasing tail here that never quite reaches zero. And another thing that happens is that the universe, the scale factor of the universe, is in sort of an exponential, is nearly exponentially increasing. And this turns out, if there are fluctuations in this field, then this exponential increase changes the characteristic properties of the field in the same way that I was describing here. So because this field gravitates, and because it lives on an expanding background, which is very rapidly increasing, then the characteristic fluctuation properties of the sound speed of the field is changing with time, and that turns out to excite it. It turns out to create particles. Another way of thinking about it, you know, in physics, there's always many different ways of thinking about the same thing. This is the way that I personally like to think about it. It's just a generic prediction of quantum mechanics on an expanding spacetime, that if you have some sort of field living on the spacetime, that the exponential expansion will just start generating particles. And so this is kind of a wild idea, but the miracle of it is that it turns out to give exactly the right initial conditions that we need for our standard cosmological model. So it gives initial conditions that are precisely of this form. They have the Gaussian property. That's actually because this Gaussian property is directly related to the fact that the ground state of a harmonic oscillator has a Gaussian wave function. That's always something that I thought was really interesting. Like normally in nature, when things are Gaussian, it's because the central limit theorem of statistics applied, the thing that you measure is not really a fundamental thing. It's like the average of many things that are statistically independent, so that when you average, when you take their average, you Gaussianize the statistics. But if this quantum mechanical explanation is correct, then the random initial conditions of our universe, you know, the fluctuations that determine that a galaxy is here rather than there, they have a Gaussian distribution for a different, more technical reason, having to do with quantum mechanics. So you're just directly seeing a wave function. The fact that the wave function of any degree of freedom with a quadratic potential is Gaussian. Anyway, so this mechanism of particle production, the miracle of it is that it turns out to generate initial conditions with exactly the right technical properties. The Gaussianness, this nearly flat power spectrum comes out naturally. Even the fact that it's slightly tilted has more power on large, a little bit more power on large scales than small scales, happens because this potential isn't perfectly flat, but has some small slope. You know, this field sort of evolves down its potential until it reaches the bottom and inflation ends. I think I forgot to say that this theory is called inflation. Let me summarize by saying that in the meantime, you know, when this inflation was originally proposed, it was sort of a more unique theory than it is nowadays. Now we know many different ways that quantum mechanics, many different setups with different fields. It doesn't have to be an exponentially expanding universe. It can be a slowly contracting universe. Many, many possibilities for generating the initial conditions of our universe through some quantum mechanical production mechanism with some new fields and some sort of phase transition to relativistic particles. So this is sort of the last mystery in cosmology, is the last of the three mysteries. We think that the observation of Gaussian initial conditions with a nearly flat power spectrum is some sort of hint of a quantum mechanical universe. And there's more I could say about this, but I've run out of time. Like if you try to use non-quantum mechanical mechanisms, generally what happens is that you lose some of the acoustic peak structure of the CMB. Instead of seeing these, you know, nice acoustic peaks, you get something smeared out. That's generally what you get if you seed structure by some sort of mechanism which is independent in different causally disconnected patches. But quantum mechanics, you know, just operates on the whole universe and generates this beautiful set of acoustic peaks. So we have this hint that the early universe is some sort of quantum mechanical place where the particles are being generated that give rise to our initial fluctuations in a hot plasma. But we don't have more detailed information. We'd like to know, what is the actual identity of these new fields that need to be added to physics in order to get this quantum mechanical universe? What determines their potential? Is there some way to get this out of string theory or some sort of physics we don't know about? Okay. I have -5 minutes left. I was going to say a lot more about all three of these puzzles. These are really and also a lot more about the observations, about the experiments, but I'll stop here. I guess what I like about cosmology is that this physics beyond the standard model is just sort of staring you in the face. You can't even get gross agreement with the data without knowing about dark matter, a cosmological constant, a quantum mechanical early universe. And now we're trying to dig deeper and understand these fundamental mysteries. One thing that maybe I couldn't convey in this talk is how much time we actually spend analyzing data and doing statistics. I probably spend about more than half my time not actually doing this sort of theory, but just doing like large scale software development, thinking about new statistical tools. But that'll have to be a subject for a different talk. All right. Thanks. I hope you guys enjoyed this.